From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome to the China in the World podcast. Today, I'm honored to welcome to the show Susan Thornton for the first time. Susan is one of America's most respected diplomats and experts on China and the U.S.-China relationship. She retired from the State Department last summer after a 28-year impressive diplomatic career where she served under 10 secretaries of state and focused primarily on East and Central Asia. She spent the first 18 months of the Trump administration at the State Department, and most of that time as acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Public and Pacific Affairs. And during this period, she helped lead policymaking efforts around the North Korea crisis and U.S.-China relations. She was a key player on U.S.-China relations in the early days of the Trump administration and in the lead-up to and the execution of President Trump's state visit to China. She was also very involved in interagency efforts and international efforts to galvanize support for the maximum pressure campaign on North Korea prior to the shift toward diplomacy we see now underway. Like China, she has deep experience on North Korea, in fact, going back to her experience in the 90s during the Clinton administration, where she led a successful set of negotiations in Pyongyang for monitoring the agreed framework. I had the opportunity to get to know Susan when I was serving on the National Security Council working on China, and she was running the State Department China desk. I appreciated, of course, her intellect and collegiality, but was most impressed by her ability to advance U.S. goals and objectives, never in an arrogant or big-footed way, but rather carrying out her work as a diplomat in a respectful way that aligns with our country's values and principles, and in the end, reflected well on our country. We have one of those kinds of former diplomats leading the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Ambassador Bill Burns, and I put Susan in that same category. Her last assignment at state was Washington, D.C. at Maine State. She has now moved to another Maine state, actually the state of Maine, where she and her husband have a farm. But to those of us who care about China relations, we're pleased that she has taken a position as a senior fellow at the Paul Tsai China Center at Yale Law School, where she continues to be an active participant in helping to shape a constructive U.S.-China relationship. She's been in Beijing this week as part of our Carnegie Tsinghua Distinguished Speakers Program, meeting with Chinese scholars, government officials, business leaders, foreign diplomats, and students that will become the next generation of leaders. Susan, we're delighted to host you in Beijing and glad to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Paul, and thanks for that generous introduction. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I want to start out, of course, by talking about the relationship. You've been involved with it for many years, and you saw a lot from your vantage point in the Trump administration. There's a lot of talk in Washington these days about the more competitive aspects of the U.S.-China relationship, and there's many that contend that our old strategy of engagement and integration of China into the international system failed, and that we now need a new strategy toward China. You're unique in that you've got long experience over many administrations. Do you buy this notion that our engagement policy failed and that we need a radically new approach to China?
Well, these are all, of course, very timely questions, and it's a huge topic, but I put myself in the camp of people who think that our engagement policy was frankly successful. I think, you know, if you look at what China's done over the last 40 years, particularly over the last, you know, 20 years since coming into the WTO, it's just incredible to see the changes in the country, the changes in the society, and to know that the U.S. had a major role in bringing about those changes through our support for China's modernization. So, I mean, the fact that we're sitting here in the St. Regis having this podcast, to me, shows that the engagement policy has been a success. Of course, it's not an unadulterated success. There are always going to be problems in the U.S.-China relationship. And I think one of the big questions, and I think it's not really settled yet, to be honest, is whether or not the effort to bring China into the international system, and I mean that by that its institutions, its rules, its norms, its standards that underpin sort of the international discourse and mm-hmm. China's role in all of that, whether we got China far enough in so that it ends up now that it's stronger and more wealthy, contributing to that system and contributing to the further building up of that system, or whether it's going to try to create a parallel system or break out. I don't think that the jury is in yet on that. I think we still have to see.
I want to talk to you more about the international system, but before I do that, you know, if there were positive aspects in terms of U.S. interests, in terms of our engagement policy, how do we get to the point where we're at today, where there's a reevaluation? I think you mentioned this week that Richard Haass said this was the quickest shift in terms of a policy issue that he's seen in his entire time covering foreign policy issues. How did this happen? How did we get to where we are today?
Well, I really think you have to go back to 1991, to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think we had a very firm and obvious rationale for our engagement with China at that point, even though we were such different countries. And that was to cooperate against, you know, the Soviet Union and countering Soviet aggression, which was, I think, quite a successful kind of cooperation that we had during the 80s. But, you know, come 1991, this was 2 years, of course, after the Tiananmen massacre, and there was already a period of estrangement going on with China. Then the Soviet Union fell. And there was, remember, I mean, this sense of triumphalism. We had Frank Fukuyama's book, you know, the end. It was the end of history, and we were right. And so I think, you know, it was tough to come up with a new rationale for U.S.-China cooperation in that atmosphere.
So the rationale, 1979, that while we have differences, big differences, in fact, on Taiwan and other issues, there was enough of a strategic imperative to bring us together. But when that fell apart, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we've been struggling ever since then?
Yeah, I think we struggled certainly in the immediate aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think at that time, of course, Bill Clinton was coming into office. You remember he put forward this well-known admonition that we were going to have human rights be the standard by which we were going to cooperate and decide whether we were going to make a most favored nation status annual vote on China, etc. He was sort of had a pretty steep learning curve, and I think found that that was not going to be a successful way to go forward with his policy, which was all about the economy, of course. And he quickly saw the symbiosis between the U.S. and Chinese economies. Of course, the U.S. business community was eager to, China was, you know, growth was taking off at that point. Japan and Korea were moving a lot of their manufacturing to China. The trade deficit with China was already going up because of the restructuring in the Asian economies. And I think, you know, he saw that, hey, this is a huge opportunity. We need to make sure that we engage in this and don't miss out. And
but a huge opportunity primarily in the economic and trade realm then.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think mostly what he was focused on was getting the opening in the sort of Chinese market and to make sure that China's economic opening was done in an orderly way, that it was done in the context of the international trading system that the U.S. had, you know, built and was sort of at the heart of. And so, you know, we started the WTO negotiation accession discussions. It was a very long period and and period of struggle, and he worked personally, you know, to bring domestic opinion in the U.S. around to the notion that we should move forward on this. And it took a long time and a lot of work.
And in the Bush administration, it's interesting. I mean, your point about, you know, it's driven kind of by the economics and trade. The main kind of form for engaging China during the Bush administration was the strategic economic dialogue. It wasn't even the strategic and economic dialogue. It was really Hank Paulson driving that. But then in the Obama administration, it seems like other issues began to come to the foreground, cyber issues, South China Sea. Did these issues and tensions and disagreements with China then begin to bring people out that questioned whether or not we had the right approach? How do you see the unraveling of that taking place.
Yeah, I think already during the Bush administration, and you'll remember this, we had a lot of trade frictions with China as soon as they got into the WTO, basically. But remember, we also had 9/11. And so there was this kind of strategic imperative and logic to U.S.-China cooperation in the against the backdrop of the Great War on Terror and all of the cooperation against terrorism that was going on around the world. And so the issues related to trade frictions kind of fell a little bit to the background, I think. Then, you know, once Obama came into office, of course, we had the change in leadership in China, Xi Jinping coming in as the general secretary of the Communist Party in China. And certainly after the great financial crisis, I think was a real break point where China started to really question the rationale for following the U.S. kind of on economic issues as they had been, and sort of looked at U.S. leadership and started asking a lot more questions, which dovetailed, of course, with Xi's coming into power and a more kind of aggressive, assertive role for China in the world that he brought, I think.
Now there are questions, and you talked a little bit about the international system. In the United States, there's a number of people who contend that, you know, China wants to overthrow the international system, create its own as an effort to kind of overtake the United States. That's one sort of extreme view. There's others that point out that, look, it's worked really well, the international system. And you hear Chinese experts say this, hey, it's worked out well for us. We're not interested in overthrowing this. At the same time, you know, there seems to be a question about whether the United States is still supportive of the international system that we frankly helped build in the aftermath of World War II. How is this going to be going forward between the U.S. and China, a point of friction, or can we work together to kind of update and revise the international system in a way that works for the United States, China, and the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's an open question, and it's one that we have to get quickly to looking at and discussing with China. I think one of the issues that I do worry about is there's a pretty big absence of conversation right now on all of these issues. But I agree with you. I mean, a lot of people talk about China being revisionist. I don't really see that. Most Chinese say that they want to keep the international system. It served them well, but they want to change it or update it or adjust it. And we don't really know much about what they want to do. They've been fairly vague about that, I think. Certainly the U.S. should want to preserve and, you know, reform and make, again, vibrant the international system that has served us so well, especially in an era where you have other countries' power rising in the international system in comparison. And, you know, the international system is all about placing constraints on major powers and allowing for smaller powers and middle-sized powers to have to preserve sovereignty and space for decision-making. That's been something that we've traditionally defended.
These are really, really important questions, and I think will have an impact on the course and trajectory of our relationship as well. One of the things that's sort of out there in the realm of the immediate is this trade deal and these trade negotiations that are taking place. And we've talked a lot about those this week during your time out here. How important is this at this particular juncture for the U.S. and China to get a trade deal? And what needs to be in the deal for it to be a success from a U.S. standpoint?
Yeah, I think it's pretty important to get some kind of a success marked in this relationship in the pretty near future. So, and right now, the only thing we're really talking about with China is this trade deal. So I think it's pretty important that we be able to show that we can work together, that we can have a negotiation, that we can reach a successful conclusion, that we can get some progress on various issues. Of course, the trade deal that we've been working on will also help push forward China's reform and opening, which is something that has been at the center of our effort to engage China from the beginning. And I think that's an important ingredient in whatever deal comes out. So that means that a deal can't just be about purchases. It also has to be about reforms and opening and a lot of the structural issues that people have raised. And I think in order to have it be a success and have it be embraced by the international community and the U.S. business community and the U.S. public, mm-hmm. that it has to include some of these fundamental protections, you know, the things like regulations on foreign investment, open market access, no forced transfer of technology, mm-hmm. forced joint ventures, protection for intellectual property rights.
Those structural issues seem, I think I would agree with you, are important. And from our discussions this week, I do get the sense that many in China have seen these negotiations as an opportunity for them to use it in their own interest to drive Chinese reforms forward, that the notion that in order for their economy to continue to grow and be successful, they need those reforms themselves. And this, to me, seems like the win-win in this trade deal. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's interesting how many people have mentioned that there are these interest groups also in China that are resistant to changing and making the kind of adjustments for efficiency that the economy needs right now. Of course, reform is always hard. We find that in our system and any country, you know, it's always difficult to try to break these iron rice bowls and move forward and push interest groups to change. But I think what we're hearing, at least from the reformers, is they're welcoming this kind of push. Whether they can actually get it done, though, and get it implemented, I think is a big challenge.
They've welcomed the outside pressure.
Yeah.
Now, Craig Allen, the president of the U.S.-China Business Council, as you and I have talked about this week, he's expressed optimism on this trade deal. And I agree with you. I think it's really important that something be done. But he makes the point that the essence of the conflict is not really about trade. Rather, it has to do with technology, and that the trade war in 2019 will morph into a tech war, and that it will mark a change in that direction, making life much more complicated for both the U.S., especially Silicon Valley, and China. Do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly hope that that's not the case. I mean, I think it's going to be very disconcerting to China to have worked this hard to get this trade deal and then have, you know, no sooner is the ink dried and someone's mm-hmm. declaring a new war on them. And I think that will only serve to cement their fears that the U.S. is working to contain China, to undermine its success, to try to set it up for failure. I think technology is an area where there's been a lot of loose talk and a lot of confusion, but frankly, hasn't been a lot of productive discussion. Mm-hmm. In the Obama administration, we did have good discussions with the Chinese on various aspects of cyber warfare, cyber theft of intellectual property, and other kinds of criminal hacking and cyber activity. And I think it's really unfortunate that all those talks have dried up and dropped off under this administration, and it's just contributing to the kind of loose talk and confusion around these issues that are so important for economic growth for every country in the world, but especially the U.S. and China.
So you think this is an issue that could be put smack dab in the middle of U.S. and China official discussions, bringing back sort of these working groups to try to resolve some of these issues? Right now, they seem to have those dialogues seem to have gone away. Is there a possibility that this can be put back into the official channel and find more constructive solutions?
Well, it's hard for me to say what would be possible in this administration, but it is quite shocking the extent to which all of the discussions that we've had with China on any number of areas of both cooperation and also disagreement have completely fallen off and opening up a big landscape, in my opinion, for misunderstanding, miscommunication, and that's something that I do worry about a lot.
You know, it seems to me that when I talk to folks in the administration, they say, well, you know, in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, these dialogues got out of control, they got too big, we couldn't really achieve our objectives, or somehow played into China's hands. And, you know, frankly, you know, there's some validity to some of those points. But it seems to me if I were there, one would be wanting to restructure or reform those dialogues, as opposed to simply getting rid of the dialogues. That seems to be something that's not in our own interest to do.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is diplomacy. This is what diplomacy looks like. You get on a plane, you go somewhere, and you have a conversation with someone, and that's just not happening right now. And I have to tell you that, you know, we made a lot of progress in a lot of these dialogues with the Chinese that is being kind of cartoonishly ignored or dismissed currently. I mean, think about, you mentioned the strategic economic dialogue with Hank Paulson. The big issue with China during those discussions was about currency valuation and appreciation of the Chinese renminbi.
Right.
Through those discussions, we actually got an appreciation of the Chinese currency of 50% over those years, and that's not an issue that we talk about anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at all the issues that we talked about in those dialogues in the 90s and the 2000s, the issues we were discussing there, we're not talking about anymore because most of them have been resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do take strong exception to people who say we never got anything out of any of this diplomacy that we've conducted with China over the years.
Well, even if it's the case, I mean, I would still argue that then the effort is to reform or revise
the
way they're done, not throw them out completely. I'd be remiss not to talk to you about North Korea, something that you've worked closely on going back to the Clinton administration. Following the Hanoi summit, all parties seem to be in a wait-and-see mode. U.S. officials seem to be shifting, hardening their position, where previously it seemed they were open to this idea of incremental denuclearization, sort of step-by-step, action-for-action, but they are indicating now that that's no longer on the table. North Korea, there are indications they're preparing a satellite engine test site at Sohae. Where do we go from here? What comes next after Hanoi?
Very good setup for a difficult question. You know, I was one of the people that was hopeful when this whole switch from the maximum pressure campaign to diplomacy happened. I thought, you know, we have a chance here. It's a unique set of actors.
Yeah.
You know, you've got leadership in South Korea, in the U.S., and in North Korea that's new and different, and it's a unique combination with a lot of political space, and maybe they can make something happen. I was happy to have the turn to diplomacy since we're not doing a lot of diplomacy around the world in this administration. I thought that's great. But, you know, after Hanoi, I think what we see is there's been a tendency in North Korea to creep back into old patterns.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, not clear yet that we can't make any progress, but it certainly doesn't feel good for those of us who have been in this position before. They certainly would have been disappointed with what happened in Hanoi and surprised and embarrassed probably. And so they will go back to their corner and probably for quite a long time recalibrate and rethink things. In the meantime, probably make a little bit of mischief because that's what they tend to do. And, you know, us hardening our position right now, I think, is actually not that helpful because, you know, if it's true that we're not going to be able to get too far in this negotiation on the denuclearization, then what we need to do is show the international community that we're making every last effort to, you know, give North Korea the chance to do the right thing so that we can set up for a future scenario in which we have to come back in with the international community and you know, regroup and put the coalition back together on pressure. And so I think we don't need to be hardening our position now. We need to be, you know, leaning forward.
One gets the sense that, and you were there in the early days of the Trump administration, but one gets the sense that the strategy was really built around President Trump himself. This is, you know, before they brought in Steve Biegun, for example, just by the sheer virtue of what he considers to be his magnetic personality and ability to persuade people in the context of negotiations, that he would somehow be able to convince Kim Jong-un that this is his time to make some grand bargain. I think it seems like maybe President Trump now realizes that's not necessarily on the table. And maybe that's a good thing because the administration realizes they got to get back to the hard work of diplomacy and that he has to actually empower his negotiators. But is there a strategy yet beyond President Trump and his own confidence in his ability to get somewhere by developing a strong personal relationship with Kim Jong-un? And then secondly, and I'm going to, you know, one hard question after another, you know, what seemed to be the elephant in the room on this from the very beginning is the idea that Kim Jong-un would somehow be willing to give up even that minimum deterrence that he's developed that I think probably gave him confidence going to the diplomacy. I think the maximum pressure campaign was helpful, but I think in some ways it was even more important that he demonstrated a minimum level of nuclear deterrence and could gain some confidence through that. The idea that he would give that up, there seems to be a disagreement between the intel community and the White House on that question, and that seems to be a big question.
Well, yeah. I don't think in the course of Manhattan real estate deals that President Trump had met a North Korean before. And we shouldn't forget in discussing what's going on with North Korea that we're dealing with the North Koreans, and most of the problem lies on their corner, right, not on our corner. Mm-hmm. That said, I was, you know, hopeful that this leader-level diplomacy could give us a comparative advantage in this round that we hadn't ever had before, because you well know you're dealing at the working level with North Koreans, but you never know what the leader is getting from those people. You don't know what he's thinking. And really, in North Korea, that's the only thing that matters. Mm-hmm. And so being able to go in with our leader, which we've never been able to do before because no other presidents had the political space to do that.
Yeah.
They would have been crucified, as you well know.
Yeah.
I thought, well, you know, this is mixing it up. And,
so you were willing,
you know,
to
maybe
give it a,
give it a shot. Yeah, I thought it was worth trying, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We weren't getting anywhere at the working level, and that was a function more of the North Korean side than it was of our side, frankly.
Right.
And so I don't know that going back to working level negotiations, to be honest, is going to really... I mean, Steve Biegun's perfectly competent, and I wish him all the best, but it's a function of the North Korean problems, not so much that we do or don't have the right negotiators. Certainly, we wasted a lot of time in trying to find somebody and putting things together and making logistical arrangements for two leader-level summits. But that said, you know, it's a problem really on the North Korean side, in my view.
They seem to have left the door open. I mean, even the North Koreans were speaking somewhat positively and not giving up hope, leaving the negotiations. The activity at Sohae is a question, but in some ways, it's not surprising. The North Koreans, when they're frustrated, they'll do those kind of things to get attention. And there may have even been more for the South Koreans to get them galvanized to try to push the process forward. And President Trump seems to have taken the news of Sohae to say, well, we'll wait and see what's going on here. So it seems like they've left a window open for something to happen. If you were there at the State Department, what would you be trying to push now?
Well, we certainly, I think, want to see the diplomatic process continue. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to do that now because we've gotten some indications. I mean, the whole process of diplomacy is to test Kim Jong-un's intentions. And you mentioned that, you know, this is his nuclear deterrent.
Yeah.
Security is very important to him. This program was part of his promise to his people, two things he was going to deliver, this one and then the economic development. And so it's really a hard structure of a negotiation to conduct because it doesn't seem like there's any obvious way or convincing way to get him to give up this thing that is so valuable to him.
Well, let me shift to another tricky topic, another difficult issue, and that's other security issues in the Asia Pacific, Taiwan, South China Sea. These are two pressing security issues we haven't touched on yet, but they're two of the most immediate concerns, it seems to me, in the relationship that haven't been frontline in large part because of the negotiations on the trade and economic issues. But we saw last September, for example, the USS Navy destroyer Decatur came within 45 yards of colliding with a Chinese destroyer during a freedom of navigation exercise. And it sort of highlights, you know, the dangers that that are there. How can we ease tensions in the Asia Pacific? How can we avoid moving towards much more confrontation there or potentially conflict?
Well, One of the things that we were able to do in the Obama administration was to put in place some of these consultations on crisis avoidance, you know, rules of behavior in the seas and in the air, to try to hopefully head off another crisis. I think it is concerning the extent to which these very sensitive issues and potentially, you know, crisis-laden issues have not really been discussed between the U.S. and China. Particularly, you know, the issue of Taiwan has really sort of receded to the background, but it's still there. And people, you know, remember early in the Trump administration, or right actually before he was even inaugurated, he took a call from Tsai Ing-wen, which, you know, sort of set the alarm bells ringing. And then we sort of recovered from that. And it hasn't really been a major point of friction or tension since, but that's because people behind the scenes are doing a lot of work to keep things stable and balanced and send signals of reassurance and understanding. And, you know, that needs to continue to happen, because if we don't have a continuing level of communication and discussion on issues like Taiwan, on issues like the South China Sea, there could be mishaps and accidents that could escalate very quickly, and especially in the current environment where we don't have a lot of conversations happening with China.
You mentioned the military-to-military dialogues that were taking place and coming up with safety procedures for air-to-air. And are those dialogues still ongoing, or have they also sort of been moved to the side, canceled, suspended? Are we having that dialogue? Because it seems so critical to me. I mean, I think to myself, you know, I remember, as you do, the EP3 crisis, where two of our aircraft collided along the Chinese coast. And we were able to work through that crisis at the time. This was April 2001, largely because we had leaderships in Beijing and Washington, D.C., that saw it in their own interest to find a way to resolve that, to work through it, get the relationship back on a more constructive footing for our own interests. I'm not sure, given what I see out of the Trump administration, even what I see here in China, whether that would be the same dynamic this time. If two of our ships collided, or we had some sort of inadvertent collision, I think it could be, you know, quite damaging to the relationship. And so you've mentioned this week the importance of these crisis management mechanisms, procedures for de-escalating crises. Are these kind of things ongoing in the administration, or do they need to be brought up?
Well, I think that's very important, and we need to have conversations going on at the working level on things like the rules of behavior in the air and the sea. We need to have them going on at, you know, higher levels as well, more strategic kinds of discussions. I think some of the working level conversations are happening, but I'm not confident that that would be enough in the event of a crisis to be able to allow us to manage it effectively.
And then lastly, on the Taiwan issue, which you mentioned, you know, we're approaching a presidential election there in 2020. Do you think that as we approach that, the Taiwan issue could potentially become more delicate?
I definitely think it will become more delicate as we approach the election, for sure.
And then what are the kind of things that we should be thinking about to avoid problems or increased tensions there?
Yeah, I mean, one problem on the Taiwan issue, of course, is that Beijing and Taipei aren't really having much of a conversation right now. So it's more important than ever that Washington is keeping open channels of communication to both sides and making sure that signals are being read correctly. There's a tendency for a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding in these kinds of signaling and actions, especially around sensitive political events like an election in Taipei. So I think it you know, behooves this administration to pay attention to this issue, which they may not have had on their radar very much recently.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake for China not to have those channels of communication. I mean, you and I were both there during the latter days of Chen Shui-bian, when he was the last DP president. In my view, Tsai Ing-wen is not Chen Shui-bian.
Right.
And seems to be somebody they could work with if China was open to the notion, but I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, she's clearly been making efforts to be very cautious and to not create problems or tensions in the cross-strait relationship. But, you know, she's going to have to run in an election and she's going to have to take stands on issues. And so there are potentialities there for problems.
Well, Susan, thank you very much for joining us this week in Beijing for our Distinguished Speaker Program and for joining us on the China in the World
podcast.
Thank you
so much, Paul, for having me this week. It's been a blast.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.